The Weagle Sunday, The Moral Aspect of the Question, Chapter 2. The objection to Sunday laws that they promulgate the falsehood that physical rest is the purpose of the Christian Sabbath. The Brownist dogma of the idle and cheerless Sunday, then, cannot be sustained by the only authority upon which it is professedly based, the Scripture, the written word alone. Does the fallacy of this dogma lie altogether in the day to which it is applied? This is an important point to which too little attention is paid by many Christians who are not Brownists. We come now to the second great objection to Sunday laws, namely, the unchristian and anthropomorphic idea of deity underlying the Brownist dogma which those laws embody. Mr. Tiedemann, in his Limitations of the Police Power, has struggled, with a devotion worthy of a better cause, to reason others into disagreeing with his own evidently fixed and perfectly correct view that Sunday laws cannot be defended in the United States. Few phenomena in the world of mind are more interesting and entertaining than the manner in which this clear-headed and learned writer proceeds, on page after page, to knock himself down, as it were, with each fresh club he picks up in the way of an argument in favor of these laws. Nor is his plainly apparent consciousness that he is knocking himself down and bruising himself all the time without helping his cause one particle or ever touching the other fellow who denies the constitutionality of these laws by any means the least interesting and entertaining feature of the performance. We are here only concerned with a very weak and fragile little piece of timber which he picks up toward the close of the exercises and brandishes faintly, evidently without the slightest reliance on it as a weapon. Mr. Tiedemann then feebly suggests that the fourth commandment of the Decalogue, on which all Sunday laws are based, has been claimed with much show of reason to have been originally a sanitary regulation, and yet more feebly intimates rather than suggests that therefore Sunday laws in the ultimate analysis, as the chemists say, rest upon this same foundation. Now, it has been claimed, whether with or without the show, or even the reality, of reason it is no business of this book to discuss, but at least by scientists of high repute, that very many of the ceremonial observances of early religions had their origin in an observed physical advantage gained by doing the things prescribed. They point, for example, to the frequent ablutions inculcated as a pious duty by Zoroaster, to the circumcision of the Jews, etc. And it must be admitted that many other requirements of the Mosaic Code, besides circumcision, are evidently to be referred to this idea of physical advantage, that is to say, are sanitary regulations, pure and simple. It will be shown hereafter that if Sunday laws are sanitary regulations, they are such as no American legislature has a right to prescribe. The question now before us is, was the weekly Sabbath of the Old Testament prescribed as a sanitary measure? And a careful investigation of the subject seems to compel, from any candid student, a negative answer to this question. We are told that deity created the heavens and the earth in the beginning. In the beginning of what? Not in the beginning of his own existence. Christian theological thought does not permit us to conceive of deity save as existing without beginning of days or end of life. Deity is not semi-eternal or half-eternal, an entity that once was not but shall endure forever. Deity is all eternal, ever was, ever is, ever shall be. Nor, if we could distinguish between rest and work as applied to deity, a point to be considered presently, are we to suppose that these words, in the beginning, refer to a beginning of active manifestation of deity, any more than they refer to a beginning of deity's existence? My Father worketh hitherto, and I work hitherto, doubtless of time and space and matter and all things as we know them. In the beginning, therefore, can only mean in the beginning of the particular manifestation of divine power and activity which we now grasp through our senses and which is known to us as the heavens and the earth. The beginning of the heavens and the earth was their creation by deity, is the only possible significance of this passage for us. And after an account of the successive steps of this creation of our heavens and our earth, we find the first allusion to a weekly Sabbath in these words: "And on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had made, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from all his work which God created and made." Genesis 3, verse 2, 3. As to the meaning of the word here translated, blessed, the commentators are much at variance, rightly observes Mr. Cox in his Literature of the Sabbath Question, Volume 1, page 3. Dr. Adam Clark holds that it has the meaning of to put honor upon by speaking well of. The word translated sanctified really means distinguished. The substance of the matter seems to be this: at the fiat of deity, time and space have their beginning. For a certain portion of time, the activity of deity is manifested in calling into space and subjecting to the conditions of time certain material substances and shapes. Afterward, this particular manifestation of divine activity ceases. The time when this first manifestation ceased is justly spoken of as distinguished. It is, indeed, the first great date in the history of our universe, the Day of Days. It has been said that this seventh day is distinguished by reason of the fact that a certain mode or kind of manifestation of divine activity then ceased. It has not been said that the divine activity ceased. Here, again, as we cannot imagine that "in the beginning" refers to a beginning of divine manifestation, save as regards our universe, so we cannot imagine that the words "God rested" imply either a total cessation of divine activity or even anything more than a change in the mode of its manifestation in this heaven and earth of ours. We shall see presently that it is impossible that such a rest as is here referred to can properly be observed or commemorated by physical idleness or the rest of men, and that no such manner of its commemoration is indicated by the statement that the day of that rest was blessed and sanctified is sufficiently proven by the fact that the curse of labor had not yet been laid on man and beast, and therefore a mere indulgence in physical rest could not have served as a means of distinguishing one day from another. The next mention of a weekly Sabbath day in the Bible is found in Exodus 16, where we are told that no manna fell on the seventh day, and so on that day the people rested. Later came the formal establishment of the Mosaic system, when four Sabbaths or rest periods were enjoined upon the Hebrew people. There was the Jubilee year, which seems to have been mainly intended to give the land the benefit of lying fallow, as we say, and to prevent its exhaustion by unremitting cultivation, Leviticus 25, verse 8, etc. And the Sabbath of the seventh year, apparently designed for the same purpose, verses 2, 7. Compare Leviticus 26, verse 33, 35, and 2 Chronicles 36, verse 20, 21. And though from the face of the record it might be claimed that these two occasions were set apart for economical reasons alone, yet from other passages, and especially from the New Testament scriptures, we know that there was a deep religious and spiritual meaning in these, as well as in all the other ceremonies and ordinances. That Sabbath of the tenth day of every seventh month, when not only were the people commanded to abstain from work under penalty of being destroyed, but as to which it was proclaimed that the soul which was not then afflicted should be cut off from among his people, was not only a religious Sabbath in the strictest and most exclusive sense of the term, but it was the only Hebrew Sabbath which corresponds with our notion of a fast day. See Leviticus 23, verse 27 to 32. The only weekly Sabbath was explicitly established by the fourth commandment. Two reasons are given for its establishment. We are told in Genesis that the deity rested from the work of creation on the seventh day. And in Exodus, this fact is adduced as the reason why the Hebrews shall rest on the same anniversary. Exodus 20, verse 8 to 11. But in Deuteronomy, the rest seems to be enjoined on this people merely in commemoration of their deliverance by the Lord their God from the hands of the Egyptians. Deuteronomy 5, verse 12 to 15. The double sanction, says Dean Millman, on which the observance of the day rested, reminded every faithful Israelite of his God under his twofold character of Creator and Deliverer. 1. History of the Jews, Harper's Edition, Volume 1, page 97. But this deliverance from temporal bondage was intended to be but a stepping stone to their knowledge of him as the deliverer from a greater bondage than that, the bondage of sin, as the transactions at Sinai clearly indicate. The evident design of the Sabbath was therefore to keep in the minds of the people the knowledge of God as Creator and Savior. Exodus 31, verse 13, 17. It is true that it was difficult for many of the Hebrews to rise to this spiritual view of the Sabbath. It would almost seem that the temporal aspect engaged their attention to the practical ignoring of the spiritual, and that therefore the character of the day as a national anniversary, or holiday in modern parlance, took precedence of the religious anniversary or holy day. Yet admitting all this, yea more, admitting it even as the meaning of the institution, it still remains true that in neither of these aspects is there the slightest reference to physical benefit or sanitary considerations. It would hardly be pretended that the institution of a national anniversary like the 4th of July was a measure for the conservation of the public health. And certainly no secular consideration can be connected with the purely religious requirement to rest in commemoration of the rest of deity. And so, Mr. Tiedemann, while correct enough in saying that it has been claimed that the Hebrew Sabbath was a health ordinance, as indeed what has not been claimed at one time or another by defenders of Brownist Sunday laws, goes wide of the mark in adding with much show of reason the fact being that the sanitary or economic object of the Fourth Commandment can be claimed neither with the slightest reality nor with the slightest show whatever of reason. This, then, was largely the ancient Hebrews' view, that he had exhausted his duty under the Fourth Commandment when he abstained from work, when he indulged in physical rest. But now, should the idea of a physical rest, this holiday-making of the day, have anything to do with the Sabbath from a Christian standpoint? Should the failure of the ancient Hebrews to discern the deep spiritual intent of the Sabbath be repeated by Christians? Should their limited view of the institution be adopted as the divine meaning of the institution, or of the commandment enjoining its observance? That remarkable people, the Seventh-day Adventists, whose headquarters are at Battle Creek, Michigan, insist that it should not. Let us briefly consider the ground of their contention herein, with the reservation that the writer speaks without express authority from them, and only from his understanding of their position as gleaned from books and conversations with certain of their members. There was indeed some excuse for the holiday manner of remembering the Sabbath by the Hebrews in Palestine. Having been kept so long in the hard and cruel bondage in the iron furnace of Egyptian slavery, and not having been allowed to keep the Sabbath when required to do so by the positive direction of the Lord, Exodus 5, verse 4, 19. It is not strange that, in their ignorance of spiritual things, their sudden deliverance into complete independence and bodily ease should overshadow the spiritual deliverance, the deliverance from the slavery of sin, which their temporal deliverance was to prepare them the better to appreciate, and of which the Sabbath was to be to them the sign. But with Christians, the case is widely different. Living in the light of all the Scriptures and of the life of Jesus Christ Himself, God with us and Lord of the Sabbath, knowing through Him both Creator and Savior, the deliverance from the bondage of sin, Romans 7, verse 14, 25, knowing in Him the power of God to create man anew, Ephesians 2, verse 10, knowing in Him that blessed spiritual rest from the fruitless toil of our own works, Matthew 11, verse 28, 30, Hebrews 4, verse 4, 5, 10. Knowing all this, and living in the light of the Christian age, Christians are to remember the Sabbath day, say the Seventh-day Adventists, in the full and deep spiritual significance of the divine precept which the Hebrew mind so largely failed to discern. Remember the rest day, say the Adventists, to distinguish or set it apart for what? For idleness? For physical rest? Would this in any wise answer to the only reasons that have any significance for us? Shall we presume to liken our physical inactivity to that mysterious rest of deity which he enjoyed at the completion of creation, which he gives to the weary, enslaved soul, and which alone the day is designed to recall to our minds? For Christians, say these Adventists, the command is to remember the rest day, not on that day alone, but all the week, that they may not so weary their bodies as to be unprepared when it comes, to set it apart and distinguish it to the utmost of their energies in good works and in bringing their spirits into the closest possible communion with the great spirit of the universe, concerning whose operations in the material world the most wonderful thing of all revealed to us is the rest of the first Sabbath day. It is quite as much a profanation of the Christian Sabbath, the Adventists maintain, to spend it in physical idleness, or rest, or to utilize it as a holiday, as it is to spend it in the pursuit of our ordinary avocations. For, though no man can, by searching, find out God, and it is not given us to know fully in this world what true significance may attach to the statement that the Creator rested, though we may not understand fully just what his rest was, we may clearly enough appreciate, they say, that there is one thing it could not have been, namely, a physical rest, or a rest in any sense in which the word can be applied to human beings. For, they argue, as God is spirit, the only rest which he could have is spiritual rest. And as it is his rest, and not our own, which we are to remember and to celebrate, it follows that true Sabbath rest is spiritual rest alone. This certainly seems unanswerable. But at the very foundation of the union of church and state lies a gross anthropomorphism, which regards deity as a mere magnified monarch of the human type. And in nothing is this repulsive and blasphemous conception more strongly manifested than in the union of the Brownist church with the state, which is embodied in Sunday laws. In the very Sabbath schools of the Brownist faith, the little children are, more or less deliberately, the degree of deliberation is immaterial so far as the result is concerned, taught to think of the Almighty Creator of the universe as an overtaxed laborer who took a day off after he had called our time and matter into being out of nothingness. But this, though pure Brownism, as embodied in our Sunday laws, is surely not Christianity. Is it not Christian doctrine, as held by the Seventh-day Adventists and formulated by St. Augustine? It cannot be that God was spent with his work and needed rest like a man. The great apostle to the Gentiles was at infinite pains to develop and impress the essential spirituality of the Master's religion, its entire independence of all forms and ceremonies and external observances whatsoever, and to elucidate the spiritual significance for Christians of many things contained in the Old Testament books. And upon nothing did he more strenuously dwell in this connection than upon the spiritual nature of the Christian Sabbath. See Hebrews 4, verse 1 to 11. And our Brownist Christians understand perfectly that the Christian idea of a Sabbath has no connection with physical rest. They show by their actions that they correctly apprehend the spiritual nature of the occasion. They do not rest themselves. They do not allow their children to rest. Many of them will not employ servants who insist on utilizing the Brownist Sabbath for purposes of rest. On the contrary, the day with the conscientious Brownist is a day of particularly exhausting and strenuous exertion. His ideal way of distinguishing his Sabbath is to spend it in the duties of devotion and in meditation on religious subjects. Now, no one will deny that the duties of devotion are as far from rest, if properly pursued, as any occupation well could be. The act of worship, as it is the highest, so it is one of the most exacting acts within the range of human exertion. It strains the faculties, monopolizes the attention, absorbs the energies, taxes the powers to the utmost. Nor is the draft on one's capacities much less when the entire mind is concentrated, with or without an open Bible, upon the vast and awful mysteries of revealed truth. Among the Brownist laymen, then, the Hebrew idea of distinguishing the Sabbath merely by indulgence in physical rest is distinctly repudiated. And, indeed, Christian clergymen of every denomination give the lie to the pretense, hereafter considered, that the Christian Sabbath is a holiday or rest day, distinguishing it, as they do, from other days merely by working much harder than at other times and for the most part, so exhausting themselves as to be obliged to set apart a holiday, or keep a Sabbath in the Hebrew sense, on Mondays. We find, then, a second serious objection to the Brownist Sunday laws in the fallacy, the blasphemous fallacy, which underlies them, that the Creator's rest was physical, and that this is remembered by physical idleness on the part of His creatures.